From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Yes, that's when I was discharged from the Navy, and they sent me to Muskogee Veterans Hospital in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and they, in those days, kept blacks and whites separate like they did in most southern states, and they warned us, the black veterans, to come in the back door, and I just rebelled against that, and I organized a group of seven men, including myself, and we sat in, went in the front door, and sat at separate tables and stayed there until the superintendent, his name was P.T. Lundquist, came, and he asked us what could he do for us. I said, you can serve us like you serve the white vets.
Dr. Edward D. Irons, author of Only by Grace. Irons spent more than 60 years as a university educator, a business, government, and educational executive, a management and financial consultant to business, banks, and to the U.S. and foreign governments, including the United Nations Economic Commission on Africa. He served on a number of corporate boards and numerous nonprofit organizations. Irons was appointed to boards and commission by four Atlanta mayors, three Georgia governors, and one Oklahoma governor. In 1964, he became the principal organizer and the first president of Riverside National Bank, located in Houston, Texas. The bank group became the first national charter to be granted to African Americans in this country during the preceding 40 years, and in the process, a renaissance of minority bank ownership in this nation was initiated, which was his vision. Irons' parents never finished high school. However, in 1960, he managed to earn a Ph.D. in finance from Harvard University Graduate School of Business before it was common or acceptable for African Americans to be admitted to Ivy League schools. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Only by Grace with Dr. Edward D. Irons, In Black America.
A couple of days after that article hit, young black man hit my doorbell and said, my name is Taylor Randolph. I'm special assistant to Governor Johnston Murray. And I said, well, what can I do for you? He said, well, the governor read your achievements and he wants to see if you would consider taking the administratorship of the Consolidated State Institutions, which was an institution with a 1,000-bed psychiatric hospital, a 250-bed room for girls, and a 450-bed orphanage on an 850-acre farm.
Only by Grace chronicles the life and achievements of Dr. Edward D. Irons, whose accomplishments are a testament to the elevation one can reach through faith, commitment, and true dedication. He grew up in a small, segregated Oklahoma town, population 6,000, of which less than 10% were African Americans. Irons was recruited by Howard University to organize a business school. In 1970, with the help of students and faculty, the business school came to fruition. Irons organized the first full program of the National Bankers Association, serving as its first executive director. After receiving his doctorate, Irons vowed to return to the South and give back, rejecting a number of major corporate offers, including the Meade Corporation, a multinational paper manufacturer, and Chase Manhattan Bank. Another significant challenge for him was the acceptance of the deanship of the School of Business at Clark Atlanta University. In this position, he was charged with the responsibility of securing the accreditation of both the graduate and undergraduate schools with limited resources. Had it not been successful, the graduate school would have lost its 21-year accreditation. Given the fact that Irons was a member of the Board of Accrediting Agency, his quest for accreditation was successful. In spite of racism, segregation, and perpetual adversity, Irons went on to become a living testament to the power of hope and steadfastness, against improbable odds.
Everything is relative. I came up in a poor neighborhood and had to struggle to eat. So you know how that works. And God seems to pick you up and take you where he wants you to go.
I know that.
And that happened to me.
Tell us, what was life like growing up in Oklahoma back in the day?
Well, Oklahoma was Southwest, but it was typically Southern in its culture. So we had all of the disadvantages of all Southern states. I walked past white schools to get to my school. I had a small school that had 13 teachers, 1 through 12, and a principal. And classes were small. There were 5 people in my senior class. When I was in World War II, we used to sit around and talk about what we did back home. And I told them, well, I was, you know, you're beating yourself in the chest. And most of us were lying. I said I was captain of the basketball team, valedictorian, and president of the senior class. The guy said, well, you must have been the only one in the class. Well, and they were pretty close. It was only 5 of us.
Well, you said you only had, what, 6 members of the basketball team?
Yes, that's right. We traveled in one car with the coach and the Togs won the state championship in 1941.
What were some of your favorite subjects while you were in high school?
Well, we were a small school. We didn't have a lot of extracurricular activities. We were too small for football. We had basketball, but only 6 members. So all of our teachers taught 60 minutes in the hour. So we had a first-class math teacher, first-class science teacher, first-class English teacher. Those 3 subjects. I was strong when I went to Wilberforce to go to school at Wilberforce University. I did well in all of those courses because our high school teachers were first class.
I understand. They expected you to do the best of the best.
That's correct. And those of us who did our best did okay in life.
And once out of high school, did you go right into the Army or attended Wilberforce?
Most of my friends did because the war broke out the year I graduated, 1941.
Right.
And most of my classmates were drafted immediately. But for some reason, I didn't get drafted for 2 years.
Right.
This was going in 1941. I went in 1943 to Navy.
But a funny thing happened on your way to an enlistment. You took a test, and they lost it.
Yes, and I knew I'd passed it. You know, when you know something, you know it.
You know.
Passed that test, and when he told me, when I asked about it, and he said, well, we lost your test. I said, well, that's all right. I'll take it over. He said, no, we're going to send you to Williamsburg, Virginia, to become a stevedore. Well, growing up in Oklahoma, we didn't have any waterways coming into Oklahoma, so I had never heard of stevedore, so I didn't even know what it was. Well, when I got down to Williamsburg, I learned it was the laborer that loaded and unloaded ships. That's what they trained me to do.
But you got sick while you were in the Navy, didn't you?
Yeah. My group was scheduled to go to the South Pacific in the summer 1944, and I was scheduled to go with them. Wanted to go with them, but I got rheumatic fever, and they had to send me to Chelsea Naval Hospital in Chelsea, Massachusetts. That's a suburb of Boston. And I stayed there 4 months, When I got out, I had a double heart murmur, and the cardiologist said I'd be permanently and totally disabled, never to be able to do any strenuous work or play, and so we're going to discharge you. You won't be any more good to the Navy. And so they gave me a medical discharge.
Was it there you gained an interest in hospital administration?
Well, no. I went to Wilberforce to get a bachelor's degree, which is what I did. It had changed to Central State by the time I finished, Central State University.
Right.
I got a degree in business administration and came out and took a job as business manager of Moton Memorial Hospital in my hometown, Tulsa, Oklahoma, at that time. And I enjoyed managing the business side of the hospital and wanted to learn more, so I went to University of Minnesota after 1 year being the business manager of that hospital to get a degree and get a master's in hospital administration. So I did that. Was given the Sabre M. Hamilton Award for the best management, the class of 1951, University of Minnesota. Only black in the class.
I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Dr. Edward D. Irons, economist, right, financial dean, and author of Only by Grace. Dr. Irons, when you left your job at Morton to go to the University of Minnesota, you weren't promised your job when you got back.
No. For some reason, my boss said, if you stay, we'll give you a raise. If you go, we won't promise you anything. Well, I knew he did not have my interests at heart, so that led me to go on anyway, not knowing whether or not I'd have a job when I got back. But I knew that the current administrator of that hospital didn't have my interest at heart, so I didn't want to leave my fate to him, and I left and went on to the University of Minnesota to study for my master's.
But there's also a caveat to that. You left, and I don't know if this was Wilberforce or the University of Minnesota, but you hadn't collected your papers or certificate for receiving your GI benefits. You just showed up.
Oh, well, that
was that. Was that Wilberforce?
Wilberforce. That's when I went to Wilberforce. I just showed up. I was a country boy. Didn't have any money. I wasn't conversant with the ways of sophisticated educators, and so I got on the train and went to Xenia, Ohio, which is the train stop near Wilberforce, and got off the bus, which was the bus that would carry kids from the little town of Xenia, Ohio, to Wilberforce every 30 minutes, and there was a line outside one of the buildings. I said, well, they must be registering, and I went and got in that line.
Back in your hometown, you had a little problem with the black veterans having to enter through the rear to go to the cafeteria, and enough was enough?
Yes. That's when I was discharged from the Navy, and they sent me to Muskogee Veterans Hospital in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and they, in those days, kept blacks and whites separate like they did in most southern states, and they wanted us, the black veterans, to come in the back door, and I just rebelled against that, and I organized a group of seven men, including myself, and we sat in. Went in the front door and sat at separate tables and stayed there until the superintendent his name was P.T. Lundquist,
mm-hmm.
came, and he asked us what could he do for us. I said, you can serve us like you serve the white vets. And he said, well, the state of Oklahoma won't allow us to do that. I told him the state of Oklahoma doesn't have any jurisdiction over this hospital. This is federal property, and only the federal government makes the policy. And so he asked us if we would come to the office and talk to him and see if we could work something out. I said, only if you're going to change something. If you're just trying to get us out of the cafeteria, we're going to stay right here. Well, he said, I'm going to do my best. And so we followed him, and for 2 hours, we sat and talked about the situation, and he smoked 2 full packs of cigarettes in that time. And when we finished, he said, well, now, I can't unilaterally make the decision today, but I'm going to give you my word. I'm going to try to get this policy changed. In the meantime, if you want something for the cafeteria and don't want to go, just call us and we'll send you whatever you want. And I told him, well, we appreciate that room service, but that doesn't solve the problem. And so they then, and that's what they did.
Okay.
They transferred me to Hines, Illinois, Veterans Hospital, which is a facility outside Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
The word on in the hallways was that they said I was a troublemaker.
Right.
They wanted to move me to another facility. After I got to Hines, Illinois, about 2 weeks, no, before I left, there was a 2-star general that came from Washington. We didn't know what his mission was. He didn't talk to us, but we knew something was going to happen. We didn't know what it was. And within another 2 weeks, policy came down that we no longer had to go in the back door of that hospital. I was in Illinois, and so one of the 7 veterans, black veterans, that had sat in called me and told me, said, well, we were successful sitting in and getting the policy changed. So I didn't get the benefit of it, but what we hoped was this was a policy that would benefit other veterans in the future.
No,
so that was 1945. You know, the civil rights sit-ins didn't start until 1955.
That's right.
We didn't even call it sitting in. And we didn't call it anything. We just said we're going down and sit down and stay there until we get served. But we were fortunate to have them change the policy.
How did you get a position at Florida A&M University?
My first job, because when I got back to the hospital that I worked at before I went to get my master's,
mm-hmm.
kept their word. They said I could have my old job back at the same salary. Well,
right.
I had finished with a master's degree, had gotten the J.B.M. Hamilton Award for the best management for the class of 51. University of Minnesota, and had interned at a major teaching hospital, which was the first in the South. And so I had all the credentials, and so I thought he would change his mind. But he said no, and then I didn't want to work at the same salary, the same job that I had before. And so I left. God was in the plan all throughout my career. No matter what I planned, it didn't work like I thought it would, but God picked me up all along the way. So when I finished University of Minnesota with those with that prestigious award, it made statewide news.
Mm-hmm.
The Tulsa Tribune, which was the second largest paper in Oklahoma at that time, published an article covering that information and caught the eye of the governor. And so a couple of days after that article hit, a young black man hit my doorbell and said, "My name is Taylor Randolph. I'm special assistant to Governor Johnston Murray." And I said, "Well, what can I do for you?" He said, "Well, the governor," he said, "the governor read your achievements, and he wants to see if you'd consider taking the administratorship of the Consolidated State Institutions, which was an institution with 1,000-bed psychiatric hospital, 250-bed room for girls, and a 450-bed orphanage on an 850-acre farm. I mean, at least they had a farm, but it was a campus that had 850 acres.
Now, that job usually went to the African-American who garnered the most votes for the governor, didn't it?
Absolutely, and I hadn't done that, and I knew that history, and so I told Taylor Randolph that I would not be interested in working it under the conditions that they historically have done it, and if you wanted me to be administrator, you have to let me use my education and my experience to bring the institution up to national standards.
Right.
And I thought the governor would say, "Listen, who do you think he is? I'm not going to hire him."
Right.
And I went on about my business. I didn't know what I was going to do. Didn't have an alternative job after I turned down the one at Moton Hospital. So again, God stepped in. My wife and I at that time decided to go back to Ohio where I'd gone to school. And
that's where she was from, wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
That's where she was from. They lived off the edge of the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got there, her mother, my wife's mother, rushed out of the house on the porch and said, Eddie, what have you done? Is somebody from the governor's office calling for you?" And, of course, I didn't. she thought I'd done something illegal or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, when I got the phone, it was Taylor Randolph. He said, "The governor accepted your proposal. They want you to take this job." And I told him I'd just gotten to Ohio and I was tired. I needed a little rest. He said, "Well, when can you come back?" I said, "Give me a week and I'll be down there." And that's what happened.
Now, you ran into a little problem with the local politicians after someone requested that you need to hire one of their kinfolks?
Not the full story. I, you know, being naive, 27 mm-hmm. years old, second highest paid African-American in the state of Oklahoma.
The highest paid was the president of Langston, right?
Yes, that's right. I was second only to him. And so I set about doing the things that I had been trained to do and cleaning up the hospital, letting people know that the assets of the institution belonged there and anybody caught stealing would be fired. Anybody caught sleeping on the job, which, because our job was 24 hours a day, like every hospital.
Well, they was doing more than sleeping. They was sleeping under the covers.
Under the cover. And, you see, this was a big institution. I had a police force just like any small town. And so Well, I would go around at late at night sometimes, carry the police with me, and anybody caught sleeping, we would fire them, and then I'd call the next morning, call the business manager and tell him to write the check for this guy we found sleeping. Now, I had given them all the warnings so that they all knew that that was going to be my policy. You caught stealing something, you're going to get fired. You caught sleeping on the job, you're going to get fired. But the thing that really made me unpopular in that political area was that historically the local politicians, like the people who were elected from that area,
right,
to serve the state, they controlled who worked there.
Mm-hmm.
They would call up and say, I want this guy to have the managership of the storeroom, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, the storeroom had supplies to feed 1,000 people regularly, and the 450 and then the 250 had that kind of storage. Plus, because they were institutionalized, we had all of the clothing that they required, shoes up. And so we had hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of inventory in our storeroom. So whoever had it, if you didn't have systems to track it, could steal and take home anything they wanted. And they did. Well, I set up a system of perpetual inventory control,
mm-hmm,
so that I could tell when we ordered where we at. For example, we'd order thousands of pounds of beef, and the chef would order 500 pounds per meal of beef, if that's what they were going to serve.
Dr. Edward D. Irons, noted economist, business and financial dean, and author of Only by Grace. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, at kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.